Continuing our study of the parables of Jesus this evening, and we're looking tonight at two parables that speak of the stewardship that God's people are to exhibit in their lives, the parable of the minas and the parable of the talents. We'll start with the parable of the minas tonight because that's the one that I think typically gets less attention when we think of these parables. Typically, we think of the parable of the talents and talk about the parable of the talents. So we'll save that to the end, so if anything has to get the short end of the stick, it'll be the one we know a little bit better, and that's kind of the way I'm approaching it. Also, as it works out, the parable of the minas is probably chronologically first in Jesus' life, so there's another reason we can say we're doing it that way, just if you want more reasons. I do believe there's a couple slots coming up that are open for this class, if anyone's interested in signing up for it. I thought I'd mention that. It's been a while since anyone said anything about that. So if you haven't taught one of the classes before, or if you have and you'd like to again, there are a couple slots open for a couple of the parables classes. So if you'll turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 19, we'll begin with the parable of the minas. And we'll begin by reading it and then trying to set it in its context. See if I can click this one once at a time. In Luke chapter 19, beginning in verse 11... As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable, because he was near to Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. He said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom, and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas, and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him, and sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant, because you have been faithful in very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And the second came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, and you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here is your mina, which I have kept laid away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow. He said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank? And at my coming, I might have collected it with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has the 10 minas. And they said to him, Lord, he has 10 minas. I tell you that everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But as for these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. Well, it's helpful to put this parable in its context, as is helpful for any passage of the Bible. But as you're studying, especially parables in isolation from everything else, it's helpful to get some idea of the context. Jesus is now in Jericho. We have just finished the Zacchaeus scene. If we are reading our way through the Gospel of Luke, and Jesus has just said, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is the son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. And this is what leads into this parable. And a couple of things going along with that, you finish a scene like the Zacchaeus scene, and it's one of those kinds of scenes especially that will heighten kind of the disparity between two basic groups of people that Jesus was constantly in contact with. And those two basic groups of people were people that loved Jesus and people that hated Jesus. Especially at this point in his ministry, as he is making his way to Jerusalem, he's pretty well cleared the way of any fence riders or people that were kind of ambivalent about him that really didn't have a strong feeling one way or the other. At this point, you've got the servants of Christ and the enemies of Christ, and that's basically it. And he had started this long journey to Jerusalem back in chapter 9. He sets his face to Jerusalem, and he's making his way there. Here they are in Jericho. They're making kind of the final leg of the journey. And all of the people think the climax of the journey is near and the kingdom would appear immediately. And in a sense, they were right, They just were wrong about what was going to happen. The kingdom would be appearing very soon. The climax of the journey was at hand. It just wasn't at all what they expected it to be. And so Jesus tells this parable because they supposed the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. And what he goes on to do is tell a parable about a kingdom that's not coming immediately. And to at least in part give the idea that this is a little ways off before they... And they will realize in time what Jesus is up to. It's also helpful to put this in the context of first century Judea. One of the very common things when you have one kind of world empire ruling over nations everywhere else is each nation would have its own vassal king. It would have its own kind of sub-ruler who was in charge of that area very often that didn't have, you know, a specific connection to the emperor back out in Rome or wherever the empire was at this point in history. It's Rome. And what would happen is, as a new king came to power, if he had the right of the throne given to him, or if he usurped the throne for someone else, what he would have to do is make a long pilgrimage to the city of Rome, to the emperor, and officially have the emperor's stamp of approval put on his reign there in that land. And in fact, something very much like this had happened in the not too distant past in Judea. When Herod the Great died, he divided his empire up, or his kingdom up, among a few of his sons, and he left Judea to Archelaus. Archelaus had to travel to Rome to officially receive the title of king, which he did not, in fact, receive the title. He was given the rulership, but Caesar did not give him the title of king until he earned it, and he never did earn it. But Archelaus had to go to Rome to claim the title of king, and the people hated Archelaus, and in fact, they sent representatives to Rome to ask Caesar that he not be given the kingdom. And so something very much like what Jesus is talking about has happened. Obviously, you can't make a direct comparison between Jesus and Archelaus, but they would recognize this kind of story immediately because they'd done something like that. And among other things, after Archelaus received power, he built a palace and an aqueduct system in the city of Jericho. So where he is telling this parable, not only is he close to Jerusalem, which would make that something that they would think of, but he was in the very place that Archelaus did a lot of work, and so they would think of this. Everything kind of fits together for why he would tell this parable in this place at this time. And that's some of the backdrop of what's going on in this particular parable. Well, the nature of this class is we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about a whole lot of the details, but I do want to point out a few of the aspects of this parable that I think are significant, and then obviously we can open it up and talk about it however much you would like. But he begins by talking about the fact that he's going to a far country. And one of the things that we're going to see in common between the parable of the minas and the parable of the talents is both of them indicate that the consummation of the kingdom, if you want to call it, that the return of Christ, the final victory over evil, it's not going to happen very soon. You see that in a couple of different ways in the parable of the talents, and we'll come back and talk about that in a little while. Here, it's not made explicitly clear. He never says it's going to be a long time before I come back. But when he has to go to a far country, that's a pretty good indication that it's going to be a little while. You know, he doesn't hop on a 747 and overnight there and overnight back. It takes a while to travel, especially to a far country. And that is, you know, immediately what he says at the outset of this parable when they think the kingdom of God is going to appear immediately. And so this is to kind of put the brakes on their expectations right at the outset. This is not something that's going to happen immediately. Now, one of the key differences between this and the parable of the talents is how many servants are involved in receiving something and specifically what they receive. And it's different in two regards in terms of what they receive. One, it's not the same thing. It's a different amount of money. But then also that they each receive the same thing. For starters, there are 10 servants who each receive something. Now, at the end of the story, we're only going to get a report on 3 of those 10 servants. But at the outset, he calls 10 of them to him, and each gives them a single mina. And so they each receive the same amount at the outset. It's not like you have a 5 mina man, a 3 mina man, and a 1 mina man, like you might think of the parable of the talents, except it would be 2 minas, I guess, for the parable of the talents to be an exact correlation. But it's not like that. Each of them receive one in this parable. Also, their minas instead of talents. Talent is actually a weight, a way of measuring something. A mina was a Greek coin. There were all kinds of coins floating around the ancient world. You typically hear of Roman coins like denarii. A mina was a Greek coin. It was equivalent to 100 Roman denarii. So it was equal to 100 days' wage, this coin was. So a little bit more than 3 months' worth of work is what this coin was worth. Now, in the context, note that we might think of that as a pretty significant sum of money, but that's not the way it's described here, particularly in verse 17 when he returns and he says to the first servant, "You have been faithful in a very little." This is described as a small charge to have under him, and he was faithful in this very little thing. And that's especially true, I think, in the context of someone who's going to receive a kingdom. This is a person who has some kind of power coming to him. To give him 100 days' wage really isn't giving him that much. And so we need to understand it in that context. First of all, because the point ultimately is not about how much money you can, have under your charge, even in the context of the parable itself. The point's not, you're good at managing money. The point is, what kind of character do you have? How hard of a worker are you? How trustworthy are you with the things that I lay under your charge? And it's about character building, not money making, is what this is really all about, and character proving, so that when he proves his character, he will be given something even greater. But also the fact that he's given very little to start, I think maybe one of those points that you can draw something out of practically for the things that are laid in our charge and we are given responsibility over in God's kingdom today. It's easy to want to do great, great, marvelous things for the Lord as we measure great, marvelous things. It's not quite as exciting to do what we might consider to be menial kinds of things for the Lord. To do everyday sorts of things. But very often what God gives us is little things to do first. And when we prove that we're faithful in the little things, then he gives us greater things to do. And when we prove we're faithful in those greater things, then he continues to give us greater things to do. And what lies ahead of us is not merely a life of activity for the Lord, but very often what lies ahead of us is obscure and glorious activity, hard, necessitous kinds of circumstances that aren't all glory and excitement and, winning a million souls for the Lord or anything like that. Sometimes what we need to do is get out of bed on Saturday morning and go visit a widow somewhere. And that's what God would have us to do in that very little thing. And we show we're faithful in that little thing, and then we can be faithful in greater things. And I think that works in two different ways. It works both in terms of obligations that we have in serving the Lord. I think also it works that way in ways that we can glorify God, particularly ways that we might consider to be negative that ultimately glorify God. That God allows us to be tried in such a way that brings glory to him, that once we prove we can handle that, we are then allowed to handle greater trials and glorify God in that way, and handle greater trials and continue to glorify God. And if we show in our faith that we can glorify God and strengthen the faith of others in something small that we endure, then God may allow us to do something even greater in that regard as well. And that can be a sobering, scary kind of thought. Yet, I know people that you have seen that kind of thing happen. You wonder when they're going to get a break because everything seems to be going against them. Yet what you constantly see in all of it is how strong their faith is and how much they strengthen the faith of people around them as they continue to go through those things. Well, that's a little bit of extrapolation and perhaps speculation as to how that might be applied, but I at least wanted to think in those directions a little bit. And then one last thing that I'll mention, and then we can kind of talk about this parable from a variety of other perspectives that you might like to consider it, is the way that it ends is with the results. And I'm going to put up something here that I think is a good way of summarizing this. Don't make too much out of it. Don't think I'm implying something that I'm not implying, and you'll know what I mean when I put it up there. We're going to come back and see a different perspective on the same idea in the parable of the talents. But what you have in the parable of the minas are servants who are equally endowed, who make unequal use of those endowments, and it results in an unequal reward. Each of them is given one single mina, and they use it differently. And God does not reward them all the same. God rewards them according to how they used what He put in their charge. And so the man who had produced 10 minas out of the one was given charge over 10 cities. The one who produced 5 minas was given charge over 5 cities. Interestingly, when the master speaks to him, he does not give him the same compliments that he does the first. And that can be really interpreted one of two ways. The first one, he says, you know, well done, good servant. You've been faithful in very little. You shall have authority over 10 cities. The second one, he just says, and you're going to get 5 cities. And your two options are, do you say, well, this is, you know, kind of ellipsis. You presume that it is to be there because he's rewarding him. Or do you say, well, he's rewarding him for what he did, but he didn't do as well as he could. And so some of that complimentary discussion is withheld a little bit. And I don't know what the answer to that is, to be quite frank. But those are your couple ways of looking at that statement to him. The man who had one mina and hid it and did nothing with it, what he had to offer were excuses. And one of the things that's kind of surprising in both this parable and the parable of the talents, that I know I must have seen it a million times, and I surely I knew this somewhere in my mind, but it never really registered to me until today as I was looking over these parables again. The way that if you'd had asked me before I reread these parables what happened, I would have said the person that was given one thought to himself, this guy is a big scary guy and he's going to get me, and so I'm going to hide this. But that's not what happens. What happens in both of these parables is they look the guy in the eye and basically say, you're a big jerk and I'm scared of you, and so I hit it. And I don't know that I realized, or if I realized I forgot, that they were saying this to his face about him. Which we'll come back and talk about in the parable of the talents, I think suggests something about that guy and his motivations. Obviously, they're offering excuses, and if they believed these excuses, that really should have motivated them to act, which is what the master says here. You think I'm this big, scary guy? Then that probably should have gotten you to go do something about it. I'm going to condemn you with your own words, and ultimately, he takes it away and gives it to the man who already had 10. Tim? And we'll come back to a parable later on in Luke 17, I believe, that really makes emphatic that point of your proper attitude in the service you do for God. Charlie?
It seems like he's being criticized more for not doing something with it, because he admits that the master, the nobleman, takes what he has on his own. So basically, he's taking a mina that he did not give out. And so it seems like he's getting punished for not making more money, but just not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that yeah, I think that ultimately is the problem in both of these parables is, and that's what he says specifically in Matthew 25. You know, you wicked and lazy, you know, good for nothing servant. You've accomplished nothing, and the problem is they've been given charge over something. Something has been entrusted to them, and they do absolutely nothing with it. They don't they feel no sense of obligation and responsibility. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously we don't.
Right.
It's a story, so there's not a real historical person here for the story itself. But if you're standing before the Lord on Judgment Day, and this guy over here next to you, he preached the gospel his whole life and he converted 1,000 people. You preached the gospel your whole life and you converted 3 people. I don't think God's going to look at that and say, well, he converted 1,000, you converted only 3. You didn't do your job. If you were being conscientious about your work and you were being diligent about your work, that's what God wants, is you to do what He entrusts you with, not for you to have overflowing numbers about whatever it may be, whether it's preaching the gospel or visiting the sick or caring for the needy or whatever it is that is in your charge. Barry?
The point of the there's an idea of being at risk with it. You could make something out of it, or you could lose it. And I think in the parable of the talents, that's more the key there. Is he's like afraid of losing. He's more afraid of losing it than making anything of it. So he buries it or puts it and makes sure that it's safe. And I think that in just what you were saying, we do the same thing. We're more afraid of failure than we are of increase.
Shane?
Well, in that scenario, I think if he was truly knowing that this guy was a hard guy to please, when he was given the mina, if he was that afraid of the guy, he would have asked, what exactly do you want me to do with this? I mean, because I've worked for some hard people, and when they give you something, it's like, okay, what result are you looking for? You try to get some clarity beforehand instead of just waiting until it comes back. So, I didn't want to do anything with it because you're a jerk, and
And that, again, the problem is laziness and shirking responsibility. And invariably what happens when you encounter people that are lazy and shirk responsibility, whether it's in a classroom or whether it's on the job, there were times in my life growing up where I was the lazy one shirking something in the classroom. And, I'm sure you know that from some point in your life. And invariably what happens is excuses. That there's always some reason why it didn't happen. And that's what it the bottom line is. And again, in the end of the parable of the talents, it's lazy, worthless servant. You've done nothing to bring any profit whatsoever.
Well, on top of that, he tried to blame it on the master. It wasn't on him. This is all your fault. You're a hard guy to deal with, and you do all you reap where you haven't sown. But this is your fault. It has nothing to do with me.
Which is a direct contrast from the other servants who say nothing about what they've done, and what they say is, your mina has made 10 more minas. And so they make it all about his money producing, and he makes it all about, the last one makes it all about, him being this bad master or whatever. Adam? I don't know that the point ultimately is that if you and 2 friends are all being judged, that the one gets taken away and given to the person who is given the most. I think the point ultimately is that those who are faithful in their charge are going to be given more responsibility. I think ultimately the point here is responsibility, not reward. Although, obviously, to some degree, there's idea of an unequal reward. The reward here is more responsibility because you know, what is the mina? It's not money that he gets to keep. It's a charge he's been given to do something with. And so to give him another one, you know, he's given it to this guy because he's already been proven that he can produce the most, and so give him more to do more with, I think, is the idea. And I don't know that it's about taking something from one person and giving it to someone else as much as it is you continue to do good things with what you've been given. And one of the things that's different about this parable and the parable of the talents is in this one, there's no mention of darkness or weeping and gnashing of teeth. He's just had the responsibility taken away from him. And at the end, they have different levels of responsibility. And it almost seems that what's being talked about here at the end is not final judgment, but temporal judgment and temporal rewards. So the rebellious are punished. The enemies of Jesus who hung him on a cross are punished. And you can see how that's pretty clearly fulfilled at AD 70 when Jerusalem is destroyed. The one is deprived of his endowment, and there's no darkness, there's no weeping and gnashing of teeth like there is in the parable of the talents. And at the end, they have unequal charges that they now have a new kind of responsibility to fulfill. And what you might say, and I don't know you can say this, you know, exactly and directly, but in a sense, the parable of the talents picks up where this one leaves off with their new unequal responsibilities that they have to go do something with, and at the end of that one is kind of the final judgment scene. That's, you know, at least one way of looking at it. Greg, were you going to say something?
No, I was just thinking, I think more about responsibility versus the reward. So
I think it's just a different kind of responsibility, because before he's a kind of a nobleman going off to receive his kingdom, and when he comes back, he's the king, and so he has something different and, you know, bigger and better.
Like governors of a region.
Right.
Just the bond servants. It seems like a lowly position to a high position of authority. Yet he gave them each 100 days' wages. So.
Yeah. All right, well, we need to look at Matthew 25 at least a little bit before we run out of time completely today. The parable of the talents is one you're a little more familiar with, I presume. And we don't really have the time to read it. I would encourage you to read it on your own. We'll pick up a few of the verses along the way as we talk about it. And again, we need to put it in its context. First of all, the context of this parable, Jesus is going through a string of parables about being ready. And the parables of preparedness are the next two classes in this series. And so they'll actually follow what follows in the canonical order in the Bible itself. But he's just been telling parables about being ready. And now you get, in this context, a parable that follows, you know, directly on the heels of this idea of being prepared. And the first word is, for it will be like a man going on a journey. And so this is a continuation of the thought of the parable of the 10 virgins and being prepared. And what that means is being prepared, being ready for the return of Christ, does not mean that you sit by and passively wait for Christ to return. Because this parable is drawn out of that context, and obviously sitting by and passively waiting is not what Jesus wants in this parable. So readiness is active responsibility, not passive waiting. Secondly, when we talk about talents, and the other reason I did the parable of the minas first is because it got our minds at least possibly in the idea, the context of thinking about money instead of talents. Because this is one of those unfortunate things where when we hear the word talent, what we think is the English word talent, some kind of great natural ability that you have to do something, that is not what this word means in the biblical text. So talents do not equal talents. If you know what I mean when I say that, talents in the biblical text don't mean talents in English usage. That is, I think, a reasonable application of this parable, but it is not the only application, and it certainly is not an exhaustive application of this parable. So when we talk about the parable of talents, and we make it about whether you're a good song leader and you lead singing because you have that talent, we kind of missing the point and underestimating the point and selling this parable short. Although obviously it does at least to some degree involve an ability that you have. In verse 15, to one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, each according to his ability. So he gives these according to the ability that they have to use them. But that also kind of means talents doesn't mean ability, because he gives five abilities to his ability. And that doesn't make any sense. So he's giving them something that they have responsibility over. What this parable about is about is really the same thing the parable of the minas is about, and that is privileges, opportunities, responsibilities, things that God has given us charge over. He's given us a responsibility to do something with. And then what do we do with that is basically the question. Now, this is a significantly larger sum of money. If you remember, the one mina was equal to 100 denarii. One talent is equal to about 6,000 denarii. So one talent, the one who got the smallest charge of all, if you figure roughly 300 days, working days a year, what he has given him is 20 years' wages. So this is a huge sum of money. And the one that he gave to, obviously that's twice that. Five is significantly more than that, 100 years' wage. And so this is a significant charge that he has given him. Well, again, I think this is the parable you know better, so it probably works better for us not to read the entire thing, since we're short on time. But let me suggest to you, I think three key ideas that you can get out of this parable that are helpful in looking at it from a kind of a big picture point of view. First of all, is what we said already. It's not going to be immediately. Christ's return is not happening right around the corner. It might, but that's not the way we should look at it from one perspective. Another perspective, always be ready, right? On the other hand, don't be so ready that you don't do anything. Don't be like, you know, the Thessalonians who are quitting their jobs and no one's doing anything because, you know, Christ might come back at any moment. Well, the reality is we don't know when it's going to happen, and in this parable at least, a long time passes in verse 19. After a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. At the very least, it's safe to say that the way we should act in regard to our responsibilities is that we don't know when it's coming. It might be a long time, so we need to faithfully work at what God has given us to do. Again, on the other hand, you can say, in regard to being ready, you need to say it might be any moment, and so you need to be ready every moment. And so you have to balance those two ideas. In the context of this parable, the picture is, think about it long term, so you're constantly active in what God has given you to do. So after a long time, in verse 19, enough time passes for the first two servants to double their capital, which is, again, it's a pretty significant amount of money, so doubling 100 years' wages is not something you do overnight. And then also, when you think about the lazy servant's excuse, one of the things he does not say, which you presume he would have said if he had the opportunity to, is, I didn't think you'd be back so soon. I figured you'd be gone for a while and I'd have more time to work at this. Yeah, you're only gone for a week. How am I supposed to do anything in this short time? Now, he's looking for any excuse that he has. That's not one that he plays. So a good amount of time passes in this parable. And again, because of that, closely related to that, ultimately kind of the point is that the kingdom demands work from all its citizens. And you see kind of the excitement of the five-talent man. He who received the five talents went at once and traded with them, and he made five talents more. And so it's an immediate kind of activity. He's ready to go to work for his Lord immediately. Kind of urgency and promptness, that the demands of the kingdom are pressing, work without delay. And you see the rigor also with which the faithless servant is judged. He's called wicked and slothful and worthless in verses 26 and 30. This is, you know, because there is a high demand to work for God's kingdom is why he is judged so harshly. And the measurement here is not by the amount of money that they raised, but the use of the opportunity that they had. It's the difference here isn't, you know, well, he made five talents and he made two, and so this guy's better than this guy is. That's not at all the point, especially in this parable. The point is, what did you do with what you've been given? What did you do with the responsibility that you have? How faithfully did you discharge that work that I gave you to do? And if you faithfully discharged it, then I'm happy with you. And if you didn't, then I'm not happy with you. It's the use of the opportunity that he cares most about. It's the slothfulness and unprofitableness that is what he does not tolerate. And Another thing I think that kind of makes the point clear that this is something that is required, this kind of work is required, is that as he makes the point, the interpretation kind of invades the parable. Usually what happens is the parable is the parable, and then if there's an interpretation, there's an interpretation that's separate from it. Very rarely does interpretation start popping up in the middle of a parable. That's just typically not the way the parables work, but that is what happens in this parable. In verse 23, enter into the joy of your master. In verse 21, enter into the joy of your master. That is very clearly the kind of language that fits the judgment scenes in the New Testament, where Jesus says, enter into the joy that I have prepared for you. And so it's not just some kind of temporal reward that he is talking about here, but that judgment language, judgment scene language, kind of infiltrates the parable before they even really get to the point of the interpretation. And then also at the end, the place of outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth shows up again, and it's the interpretation coming out in the middle of the metaphor where you don't expect it to come. Well, I'd like to talk about a lot more, but we just don't have time. One thing that I think is worth thinking about before I put the last point up is to ask the question why the one talent man is considered the sluggard in this parable. And one thing that we might immediately think is that those who receive less are those who are probably most tempted toward negligence because, you know, you feel that what you have is insignificant and what you produce isn't going to have a lot of value, and so you're tempted toward negligence. And that's certainly a possibility. But in reality, the most tragic negligence that happens is when it's people that are the most gifted that are negligent in their responsibility. And I think maybe what's going on, why the one talent man is the negligent one in this story, is because he's the one that is probably the most easily excusable. He's the one that we would look at, probably, and most likely say, well, you know, he's just a one talent man. What can you expect of him? God's not expecting anything out of this guy because he's just a one-talent guy. But that's not what happens. The point is that there is universal obligation without any exception whatsoever. Whatever God puts in your charge, you are responsible of that charge, and you are obligated to work with that. And if the one-talent man is not excused, then nobody is excused. And that, I think, is a pretty sobering thought as well. Well, in this parable, and this is where I'll end it, and this will just be something for you to think about over the next week. In this parable, equal diligence in the use of unequal endowment results in an equal reward. And so they're given different things at the outset. Each of them are equally diligent, the 5 and 2 talent men, and they produce different things, but they're given an equal reward. At the end, the first and the second servant receive the same reward as peers. They each enter into the joy of the Lord. They're both given the same praise of good and faithful servant, which means here God measures diligence and devotion, not the magnitude of the results achieved. I'm sorry, we don't have any more time than that to talk about this more. We'll have to come back and talk about these parables more another time, I guess. Thank you for your attention and your comments.